Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Melissa Amarello. After more than a decade working on... Actually, we should start over. Did I pronounce your last name correctly?
Yeah, actually, you got it first try, because no one ever does.
Okay. How do they say it?
A lot of people want to pronounce it like Amarillo, like it's Spanish. Gotcha. But yeah, we're from Kentucky, so it's Amarillo.
There you go. Okay. Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Melissa Amarello. After more than a decade working on the conservation of reptiles in the American Southwest, Melissa co-founded Advocates for Snake Preservation in 2014 to change how people view and treat snakes. She holds a master's in biology for her studies of rattlesnake social behavior. So first off, thank you for your work, and second, thank you for being on the program.
Hey, thanks for having me. I'm always happy when people are interested in talking about snakes.
Well, let's talk about snakes and start off. Would you like to talk about how snakes are doing in general in this country, or do you want to start by focusing immediately on rattlesnakes?
Let's say a little bit about snakes in general. And I think that people will be, well, listeners of this show will be not surprised to learn that, you know, like most wildlife, snakes are having a hard time. You know, they're affected by all the things that are doing damage to other species of wild animals, climate change, habitat destruction. There's some emerging diseases that are causing problems for snakes in some parts of the U.S. It's similar to the, if people are familiar with the fungus that's attacking bat colonies and wiping out, in some cases, like very large numbers of bats. There's a very similar disease that's starting to affect some snakes, including rattlesnakes, that's also a fungus, and it seems to be acting in much the same way. So snakes have all of these problems. The numbers aren't great as far as like what percentage of species of snakes are on the decline. Many are. Unfortunately, snakes are difficult to study because they're so hard to find and track through time. So if you look at, you know, like the IUCN or some of those organizations that track how species of animals are doing throughout the world, a lot of the information about snakes just says no data. But the ones that have been well studied, a lot of those are not doing well. And on top of that, for snakes, and especially rattlesnakes, to start bringing it back to them, is that a lot of people don't like snakes or they're scared of snakes. And that makes it really difficult to implement conservation measures. So even for the few species that we do know something about, and if we know they're not doing well, and then even when we know what steps we need to take to help them, a lot of times it's really difficult to do because you need public support, you need agency support often to implement those conservation plans. And it's hard to get that for an animal that people don't like and they're scared of. And especially for an animal like rattlesnakes, which do pose a potential threat to humans, you know, bites are painful, expensive, can cause a lot of injury and illness, and in some cases have even killed people, although that's very rare in this country. That makes it really hard to get the public behind saving them. So they have that on top of all the problems that other wild animals face.
So you mentioned no data, low amounts of data, and I'm going to ask you a question for which there may not be an answer, but one of the things that always strikes me is to read about the extraordinary fecundity of this continent before the Europeans conquered it. So you have these bison that would be a herd that might pass by for days at a time, or flocks of passenger pigeons that would darken the sky for days at a time. I recently read about there were packs of wolves in what's now the Houston area. There would be like 200 wolves, and there would be troops of grizzly bears in California, as opposed to being solitary. There's no grizzly bears in California now. But the point is, do we have any, or prairie dog villages that are, you know, 1,000 square miles, do we have any accounts of how abundant some species of snakes might have been prior to this whole destruction? And I'm sorry if I'm asking a question for which you don't have an answer.
No, that's a very good question, because I think that comparing certain aspects of snake behavior to those other disappearing wildlife phenomena, like those giant flocks of passenger pigeons and the big herds of buffalo that used to roam around, and yeah, the idea of a pack of wolves in the Houston area is, it makes me very happy and very sad. So I think the correlate in snakes would be, there's some species of snakes, including some rattlesnakes, that overwinter in fairly large groups. And the size of those groups varies depending on the species and where they're at. But in the northeastern US, that used to be a pretty common thing for timber rattlesnakes. Timber rattlesnakes is pretty much the species of rattlesnakes if you are east of the Mississippi. Down in the southern US, you have eastern diamondbacks as well, but timber rattlesnakes are more prevalent. And because they were the species of rattlesnake that white settlers first encountered when they came to the US, they were also the first one to suffer from the persecution that we have wrought upon snakes, and especially the venomous ones. But timber rattlesnakes tend to overwinter, in the northern part of the range, especially in fairly large groups, sometimes numbering in the hundreds. And there's a lot of cool behavior that comes out of this, but it unfortunately makes them, much like the buffalo and passenger pigeons, as an easy target for those who wish them harm. In the spring, especially when they're just coming out for the year, they're pretty lethargic. They're going to be really slow to retreat, even when they're sitting right outside these rock outcrops where they spend the winter underground. And what people would do was is just annihilate these spots. And in many cases, they would go through and just dynamite entire dens of snakes. And so, yeah, you've got a species that was probably fairly common. Again, no hard numbers, especially from back then. And then now, in many places, have either disappeared entirely from those states, like Maine, for instance, or is very threatened and down to just a couple populations and less than a couple hundred individuals in places like Massachusetts.
And so can you tell me a little bit about what I know that creatures should exist for their own sake, but also what are their roles in their communities? Like prairie dogs, basically, as well as being wonderful creatures on their own, are food for a whole boatload of creatures. And salmon carry nutrients up into the forest. And I'm not asking about utility for humans. I don't care about that. I'm asking about what is one of their, one of the purposes of wolves is to clear elk out of river bottoms to make it so the foliage can grow there, which helps trout habitat, etc. So what do they do? Well, tell us more about who do they eat and what just. Tell us about rattlesnakes and specifically rattlesnakes. What do they do?
Yeah, no, that's a good question. And like you, usually when I'm talking about snakes, I very much focus on them and what is cool about them. But I think one of the things that is cool about them, and rattlesnakes included, is that they have a spot right in the middle. So they are not the top predator in any ecosystem, not rattlesnakes anyway. Some of the really big snakes that live in other parts of the world probably are, but not here. So they're prey for a lot of animals, and they're also predators for a lot of animals. So, because we are scared of snakes, it's hard to imagine them as being food, but they actually have a lot of predators. A lot of birds of prey, hawks, owls, medium-sized and large mammals like fox and bobcats, badgers. Badgers eat a lot of rattlesnakes. And then also other snakes. So king snakes are really famous for preying on rattlesnakes, but depending on where you are in the country, there are other species as well, like racers and whip snakes and coach whips, gopher snakes occasionally, and bull snakes. And then rattlesnakes are an important predator for a lot of prey species. And snakes don't feed very often. And because they're not really big, I think in a lot of people's mind, they think that they're not as an important a predator and not as important as a check on their prey as some other animals. But with rattlesnakes and other vipers, they're not territorial. They don't guard resources and space in the way that a bobcat or even a red-tailed hawk were. So mammals and birds that tend to hunt the same sizes of animals as rattlesnakes and other vipers do are usually territorial. So in a given area, you're likely to have way more snakes or rattlesnakes than you are those mammal and bird predators. And so even though they're not as big, they're not feeding as often, they'll have a greater impact on that prey. So they're very important to the environment. And due to their ability to go for long periods of time without food, they can wait out crashes in the prey. So if anyone's taken a basic ecology class, like there's these classic stories of lemmings and the population like tends to go up and down, and when they crash, their predators tend to crash with them because they can't handle the loss of food. But rattlesnakes and other vipers can just sort of like wait it out until their prey pops up again because they can go for months, in some cases even a year, without any meals at all. And so they're there waiting when the prey pops up again. So they have a pretty unique and important role in the environment.
So before we get more to threats, there's a couple more questions I want to ask. One of them is that in the intro, we mentioned that you hold a master's in biology for your studies in rattlesnake social behavior. I'm guessing that a lot of listeners will be surprised to hear the words rattlesnake and social behavior together. So can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, when I first started that work, and honestly, still, when I talk about it, people laugh because they're like, well, how can you get a master's studying something that clearly doesn't exist? But snakes can be social, and rattlesnakes in particular. So I've referenced a couple times how some species of snakes, and including some rattlesnakes, tend to overwinter in large groups. And we've known about that for a while. And those large groups, aggregations or communal dens is what most scientists usually refer to those. They're more common at high elevations or up north where it's cold. And the theory has always been that the only reason that those animals would be together is because there's not a lot of places where they can survive the winter without freezing to death. And there's probably some truth to that when you're talking about like Montana or northern Idaho or Canada. Like certainly there are very limited places where an animal, a snake, can get underground and survive. And so that is part of what draws them together in those dens. But where I did my work in central and southern Arizona, freezing to death is not generally what we're worried about there, snakes included. Even at fairly high elevation, it's cold. They do need to get underground, but there's lots of places for them to do that. But with some species, they still tend to group together. And so that's what I started looking at, was why we see that. And tried to approach it with an open mind. I mean, I think a lot of it is scientists just don't feel or believe, which are not words that scientists are supposed to use because they're supposed to be unbiased, but they don't feel or believe that snakes and other reptiles are capable of things like social behavior or taking care of their kids. And I try to approach it using methods and asking questions that someone's studying whales or birds or other mammals that we typically think of as being social, like how they would look at the problem, and just starting there instead of looking at it like a snake scientist. And what we found was that with communal dens that were close enough together to where you could have snakes going back and forth, spending different years at different piles of rocks, they tended to have their own little communities, and there was no mixing between the communities. So you did have a social system there. And then within those communities, the snakes were making choices about who they wanted to associate with. So we were able to identify individual snakes by using unique markings in their patterns. Once you look at snakes a lot, you notice with most of them, you can kind of tell them apart by irregularly shaped blotches or bands and sometimes scars and other ways too. And this is how people that work with animals like whales do it, because you can't just grab a whale and scan it for a microchip like we do with small animals. And it also enabled us, by identifying them based on how they look, to use cameras so we could get more observations. And we didn't have to mess with the snakes, because every time, you know, even for a rattlesnake, they view us as a threat and they're scared of us. So every time you're handling them, you're messing up their behavior and, you know, potentially like altering that situation and maybe the whole day. So we didn't have to do that. So we were able to tell who was who. And so then we could tell who liked to hang out with who. And within these communities of snakes, you would have snakes that were friends, defined mathematically, again, following the methods of people that study this in other animals, spending more than half of their time together. And then you would also have snakes that would never associate with each other at all. So within these groups, they had little enemies and little buddies that they would hang out with. And so that was kind of the start to getting at social behavior for the snakes that we studied. And I'm not the only one who's done work like this. The timber rattlesnakes that I mentioned earlier, there have been some studies of social behavior in them as well. And they did it a little bit differently. Instead of looking at individuals and how they interacted, they looked at these communal dens as a whole. And they thought, since the snakes tend to have their babies and raise their babies often near or at the dens, they thought, well, maybe these dens are actually big extended rattlesnake families. And so they did find that the females and juveniles within a den are more closely related than they are to nearby dens. So they tend to group together with their families and return to those same spots year after year after year, which is pretty cool. And another sort of social function, social dynamics that snakes have.
Well, two things. One of them is that I saw this thing maybe a year ago about how they did a long-term study of bats, where they were basically put cameras on them and then also recorded sounds, and then they would determine sort of a dictionary of bat, what different bat sounds or squeaks or words meant, by what would be the following action, and then did a long-term mathematical correlation of. And what they found is that in these really tightly dense cavities, or tightly dense colonies, that the bats, a lot of it consisted of, hey, want to come hang out with me? Or, you're in my space, get out of here, move. because, you know, a certain very specific squeak, the other bat would move an inch away. And so if you see this 1,000 times, so I mean, it's so clear to me that everybody in the world is doing this. And
yeah.
And so that's one thing. And the other thing is, you mentioned mothers and children, and how, you know, I understand how birds take care of their young. What would it mean for a mother? And I know I see bears every day, and I know what the mothers do for the children. I know how the mothers teach. For example, a mother bear will introduce a new food to the cub by eating it and then blowing her breath in the cub's face. So the cub now knows that this smell is associated with something you can eat. How does it benefit the young to be hanging around her parent, her mother?
Yeah, that's a very good question. And I'm glad you mentioned that bat thing, because, well, number one, it's cool and I hadn't heard about that study, but I think it sort of points to how some of this stuff is really difficult for us to wrap our head around with snakes. They don't communicate with sound, which is what, you know, we're used to. And that makes it really difficult for us to understand. There's some visual communication going on with different postures, I'm sure. But for the most part, they appear to use chemical signaling pheromones. And those are difficult for us to translate. They're impossible for the most part.
By the way, sorry to interrupt. There's a guy, mm-hmm. Stefano Mancuso, who's actually making a dictionary of plant pheromone communications, because they will communicate, hey, this caterpillar is eating our leaves. Y'all, you neighbors, have to change your composition. And so he's actually making, so far he's got a lexicon of like 1,500 or 2,000 or something different chemical signals that the plants send, that those are just the ones that they've been able to translate. So it's just everybody is communicating this way, but I didn't know snakes did. Can you talk more about that for a minute? That's really exciting to me.
Yeah, they're really, you know, people think of snakes as blind and deaf, and they're neither of those things. They can hear at certain frequencies, they can see, and that vision ability probably varies a lot because snakes are a diverse group. They hunt different things, they live in different places, so they do use those senses as well, but a lot of their world is very much based on chemicals. And what has been determined is that, you know, we know they use scent trails and pheromones to find females, to find food. The babies will use them their first winter to figure out where they're supposed to go den by picking up the scent trails of usually family members, their mother, to try to find where she spends the winter. And then in lieu of that, they also use them. We think this is probably the mechanism. Snakes will choose to hunt in a spot where another snake has been successful hunting. And we think that that's probably based on some sort of pheromone that other snake left behind, maybe similar to their ability to detect through scent the trail of, so when rattlesnakes eat, they usually strike and let go and let their prey animal run off and die from the venom elsewhere, and then they follow that trail. And they can actually tell the difference between the trail of another rodent versus the one that they struck themselves, and will hone in on the one that they struck. So they use it for a lot of different things, and wow, I hope somebody starts working on a dictionary of snake pheromones too. That would be really cool and would probably open up a lot of doors for studying the social behavior as well. But the original reason I brought it up was just that since we don't have that information now, it makes it really hard to see a lot of what is going on with the interactions between mother and kids. So I'll talk a little bit about what we do know, what we have observed. Rattlesnakes are one of a few groups of snakes that give birth to live young. They don't lay eggs. They have live babies. And we've known for about, well, science has accepted for about 20 years that mother rattlesnakes and their babies will stay together until the babies shed their skin for the first time, which happens a week or two after they're born. So there have been observations of that since white people have been here writing stuff down about snakes, but it was written off for a long time as, you know, the mother's too tired to crawl away or something. The usual sort of nonsense from people who don't think that snakes are capable of anything other than eating, breeding little robots. And that started to change when someone was studying them with more of an open mind and actually observed things that looked like care. So as you mentioned, it's really easy for us to identify what a mother bird looks like caring for her young, because they feed them, they bring back food. With snakes, they tend to swallow their food whole, almost all of them, all the time. So that makes it really difficult to share food. And also with a predator like a snake that feeds infrequently, the idea of them being able to catch a bunch of food items to bring back to their nest is just knowing about how little they are successful in hunting. Like, that's kind of a joke. So far as we know, they don't feed their babies, but there are other things they can do. The babies are born with enough yolk left over to where they're not probably worried about eating for a few weeks anyway. So what the mother does is they keep them safe from other threats. So when the babies are really young, the first couple days, the mother, it appears to, like, she likes to keep them really close to her. And if the babies, before they're ready, start to crawl too far away from their shelter, from their mom, she'll do different things to kind of herd them back to the nest. We've seen them kind of reach out with their face and just lightly touch the back of the snake. We've seen them place their body like a wall in between the baby and where she doesn't want the baby to go. And these are really subtle behaviors. And again, without having that ability to read the communication that's happening via, you know, chemicals and smells, we can only infer probably in the same way they're doing the plant dictionary, by looking at the response from the babies, which to any of those things that I just mentioned is to come right back to their mom and right back to shelter and not try to crawl away again for a while. And then as the babies get older, the mother kind of, you know, like any of us do, you know, same thing that humans do with their kids. You give them gradually more and more freedom until they're ready to take off. The mothers will posture and rattle and do all the things they would normally do when they're threatened by a predator, another potential threat. They will do that and seem to be a little faster to do that when they have babies present, whether it's to a human observer, like me, when I got too close to one of the mothers after she'd given birth. You know, same distance I was able to get to her when I was observing her during her pregnancy, but as soon as those babies were there, that behavior from a person is no longer acceptable and got rattled at, and she actually came towards me, which, despite the many accounts of snakes chasing people, they don't, because they're scared of us. And that's one of only two times I've had a snake come toward me. And the other one was another female with babies as well. And then we've also seen them do those same sorts of behaviors at squirrels with remote cameras that we've set up at rattlesnake nests. Squirrels don't like rattlesnakes, probably because some rattlesnakes eat them and their babies. And they appear to, they certainly harass the snakes, but we've also seen what we think are dead baby rattlesnakes that were killed by squirrels. So the mothers really don't like squirrels getting close to their babies and will posture and rattle and do very, very obvious things. And there's subtle things that are going on as well. So rattlesnakes will also babysit or help. So you'll have snakes showing up that are not pregnant females at the nest. So other males and juveniles that aren't old enough yet to have their own babies. And they'll sit out with the baby rattlesnakes as well. And especially in the case of males, in most species, male rattlesnakes are bigger than females. And so he doesn't even have to do anything, but just a bigger snake sitting there is going to be more of a deterrent to a potential threat. Like a squirrel is probably going to think twice about harassing a big male rattlesnake in the summer because he can eat that squirrel, whereas the females are maybe too small to do that. So there's a lot of other things they can do to help protect those babies and just keep them as safe as possible until they are developed enough to go off and be on their own. And I would love to know if there are some of those communicating, teaching things going on between the mother and babies. But as of yet, we just don't have the tools to observe any of that. But it's hard to imagine that there isn't something like that going on.
I love the fact that you said we don't have the tools to be able to discern it, as opposed to the presumption that if we can't observe it, it's not there.
Yeah, I mean, that's just silly. I mean, scientists talk a lot about anthropomorphizing and how that's bad, but you know, I can only see the world and interpret as a human sees it, because that's what I am and that's what all of us are. But I recognize that they see the world in very different ways. And, you know, they have this whole type of communication that we don't do almost at all. I mean, obviously there's some pheromone communication that goes on between humans, but it's pretty far down as far as what's important and what we respond to. But for them, that's their whole world. And so it would be I don't know. I just feel like it's kind of egotistical to assume that it's not there just because we haven't seen it yet. I'm sorry, we're just not that smart and all-knowing.
Well, also, a lot of the scientists, and I've got a degree in physics, by the way, a lot of the scientists who say that we shouldn't anthropomorphize never seem to have a problem projecting machine language onto the real world, that that nature is a machine, and they talk about ecosystems, and that's the whole mechanistic perspective. I mean, you can't get more anthropomorphic than to project human creations, machines, onto the natural world. So it's all just silly.
Yeah, no, that's true. And you're more likely to hear someone criticizing someone for anthropomorphizing when they're talking about animals playing or loving or having fun. You shouldn't say those words. But people throw out words like aggressive and
Oh, and
fear
ants are
all the
having
time.
wars. They have wars.
Yes, it's like that's no different. Those are just as anthropomorphic as the good feelings, but for some reason, those are acceptable. It's very strange.
Okay, so I want to start transitioning to the horrible rattlesnake around us, but there's a couple more areas that I want to ask about. One of them is, what do baby rattlesnakes eat? I mean, do they grasshoppers?
Ah, good
They
question.
can't be big enough to eat a mouse, can they?
No, I mean they could eat, like what most people feed captive small snakes or like newborn mice, but because of the way that rattlesnakes hunt, which is to sit and wait for the prey to come to them, newborn mice are not going to be like wandering around. So they mostly eat lizards. I'm sure there are some that take insects, and certainly other species of snakes I've worked with consume a lot of grasshoppers certain times of the year when they're abundant. But young rattlesnakes are eating a lot of lizards because they often live places where there are lots of lizards. And I know at our the nest sites where we've been monitoring, those are also where there's like three or four different species of lizards that hatch out or are born at about the same time as the rattlesnakes, which I'm sure it's not just a coincidence. so that's in a very abundant food source at the time when the snakes are small.
And so a couple more questions before we go there. One is, you said the word play, and I have no idea. Have you ever witnessed what you would perceive as rattlesnake play?
Ooh, that's a good question. I have not seen that in a rattlesnake. And I'm not sure if that has to do with, again, seeing something that I'm just trying very hard to like assign a purpose to everything that they do. Or, unlike a lot of the animals that we have observed play in, snakes and maybe rattlesnakes even more so, they spend a lot of time doing nothing. They're very conservative with their energies. And it's part of being ectothermic. And it's part of being an animal that, is not going to feed that much. And so possibly they just, I don't know, maybe don't spend as much time on that. Maybe you're like playing little games in their head that requires less energy. I'm not sure. I'm like rolling back in my head, thinking about especially the babies when they're hanging out in groups and they're crawling around. And yeah, there's never been anything like real obvious that we identified as play. But honestly, because we were not, I don't know, that's still like a new field and not something that I've ever tried to look for either. But yeah, now I'm going to be thinking about it more the next time we are setting up cameras on snake babies, especially, but adults too.
Okay, one more question before we go to the horrors, and that is, how can you describe your process of falling in love with snakes and rattlesnakes, especially with an eye toward how that might help others to do the same?
Yeah, I was the little kid, one of many little kids who's really into dinosaurs. And that kind of transitioned into alligators and crocodiles, because I guess that was the next biggest thing, and because they're still alive. And then snakes came into the picture a little later because I didn't live in Florida where I had alligators or crocodiles in my backyard. I lived in Kentucky where we had garter snakes in the backyard. And I think because I was able to make that personal connection with them, you know, I got to see and hold one when I was really young, and no one had taught me that they were bad or scary. I mean, we went to church, so I'd heard that story, but was kind of critical of it, like a lot of things. And yeah, so I made a personal connection with one. My initial encounter with a snake wasn't anything scary. And even as a little kid, I learned pretty quickly that that attitude was not unique, but not common. You know, most of my friends were scared of snakes, even though, you know, my pet snakes were totally harmless and like pretty nice. But yeah, I started figuring out that a lot of people didn't like them. And I think I just have a natural affinity towards underdogs and groups of animals or people that need help. And so even though I've worked a little bit with birds, I kept coming back to snakes because people don't like them, they're scared of them. And it became pretty apparent that that was affecting our ability to help them. And I just, yeah, I like standing up for those that need help, and snakes are certainly one of those groups.
So we have like 12 or 13 minutes left, and on one hand, I'm sorry that we've short shrifted the rattlesnake roundup, but on the other hand, I'm not at all because I've loved everything you've said. It's been fabulous.
Well, thanks.
But having said that, now let's jump to something that people may not have ever heard of, and I think both you and I wish did not exist. So can you tell people what rattlesnake roundups are? How many there are, and just let just that's all.
Yeah, I can. And actually, I'm kind of glad I don't think anybody wants to hear more than 10 minutes or so about rattlesnake roundups. So rattlesnake roundups are a variety of wildlife killing contests. And there are a variety of wildlife killing contests in the US, but most of them are not very well known because they go after animals that most people like. Because rattlesnakes are not well liked, these contests are pretty public, and certainly in the areas in which they are held, most people know about them. Although, yeah, throughout the country, they're not as well known. Rattlesnake roundups take place in Texas, Oklahoma, Alabama, and Georgia, or I should say, the traditional killing type of rattlesnake roundups still take place in those four states. And basically, if you can picture any county fair or small town rural America festival, it's that. So you've got your corn dogs, you've got your lemonade, you've got your cheesy little rides, you know, your pony rides, your flea market, your concerts at night. And with a rattlesnake roundup, on top of that, you also have this whole section where they're bringing in hundreds, or in some cases, thousands, tens of thousands of rattlesnakes that they collect for weeks to months before the event, to bring in, do various displays with. But finally, they all end in slaughtering them. Sometimes that's done on site at the festival. You can have your lemonade and cotton candy and watch them behead a rattlesnake with a machete and skin them while they're still wiggling around. At some of them, you can pay money to skin your own rattlesnake. And in others, that's done kind of behind the scenes. The only thing you see at the festival itself is they do shows where they milk venom. They do these so-called educational presentations, which are, at least at the roundup I've been to, an interesting mix of myth and propaganda, and also a few actual facts about snakes. But at all of the roundups in those four states, they end in death for the snakes. They're put forth by the organizers and the fans of roundups is something that they need to keep snake populations in check. Most of these festivals started in the 50s or 60s. There's probably a few that are older than that, but most of them started in the 1950s and 1960s. And they claim at the time that rattlesnake bites to humans and livestock were such a problem that, you know, the ranchers weren't able to make any money. The police weren't able to do anything else because they were answering so many snake calls. And granted, medical treatment has for snake bite has come a long way since then. And I imagine that snake bites were a bigger problem then. I don't know about the issue of police not having time to do anything else. Having lived in a state, Arizona, that has the most rattlesnakes of any state in the U.S., we don't have roundups or any other sort of mass calls of snakes like that. They're protected somewhat in the state. The police have plenty of time to do everything else they need to do. It's really not a big deal. So I don't know about any of that, but I do know that rattlesnake roundups are certainly not required to keep populations in check. Rattlesnakes are not overpopulated anywhere. Unlike many species of animal, they still have basically all of their natural predators. I mean, I'm sure wolves, when they were around, hunted rattlesnakes too, and mountain lions in places where they have been extirpated also hunt rattlesnakes. But there are a lot of other predators that are still around and doing fine that rattlesnakes have, plus the disease, fluctuating prey populations, all that stuff that normally keeps wild animal populations in check are still around for rattlesnakes. But what these festivals do provide to the community that's very real and probably very important and why they keep fighting to not have their roundups taken away is money. They're a big draw. These usually take place in small towns where there is not much going on. They're sort of the typical town where, you know, whatever industry that was once there has left, and now they just don't have much, but they have these big once-a-year festivals where the town's population triples in size, and that provides enough money to the local economy to kind of get them going through the year. And I can empathize with that. I grew up in a small rural area of the Southeast. My dad worked for Philip Morris. He made cigarettes. And I know what it's like when, you know, a business like that goes away. And there are very good reasons why a business like that should go away. But, you know, it does make a big impact, a big negative impact on the local community. So I understand their fear with having the roundups taken away. But the events are unsustainable. There's no limit on the number of snakes that people can bring in. They are rewarded, in fact, for bringing in the most and the biggest snakes, which is sort of the opposite way that people usually manage hunting and manage game. In some parts of the country, in Georgia and Alabama, the rattlesnakes that they target are proposed for listing under the Endangered Species Act, not solely because of roundups, but roundups have certainly contributed to their decline, which has been severe. And the only reason they're not on that list yet is because they're snakes, and again, the limited data thing. However, what we don't get with a lot of environmental issues is there's a way that could work for everyone that could keep the snakes from being killed and could also preserve this important economic driver for these communities, and that's that many roundups have changed, and there's still festivals. A lot of the festivals still focus on snakes or are now snake and wildlife festivals, but they don't kill the animals. They either bring in animals from the wild and put them on display, have real education, and then let them go. Or they have people with captive animals come in and give talks. And the draw for most people are the other aspects of the festival, the community aspects of it, or they just want to see the animals. Most people really aren't into the slaughtering, bloodthirsty aspects of it. I mean, for many people in these communities where the roundups happen, you know, this has been very normalized for them because they've been going since they were kids. But in other places where they've transitioned their roundups into these no-kill wildlife celebrations, people have adapted and they haven't lost money. In fact, many of them have more people attending their events, and they're bringing in even more money, which is just fantastic. So you actually have a win-win situation for, you know, industry or the economy and for wildlife. And, you know, like I said, there are four states that have traditional kill roundups now, but, you know, even within the last 10 years, there were more than twice that many states that have roundups, but they've either just gone away or transitioned into these other sorts of events, which is fantastic. And we just want to keep pushing for the ones that still have the kill events to move toward this other model that can absolutely work in their communities as well, I think.
So how we still have 3 or 4 minutes, and what have the strategies and tactics that have been used to attempt to decrease the number of rattlesnake roundups, and how can people who are listening to this interview assist in those efforts going forward?
Yeah, that's a very good question, because there are definitely tactics that have not worked. So protesting, you know, using language about wanting to shut down rattlesnake roundups, that just causes them to dig in their heels and just be more determined than ever to keep their roundups going. The heart of rattlesnake roundups is Texas, and Texas doesn't like outsiders. I mean, most people don't like outsiders telling them what to do, but Texas seems to have an especially strong opinion like that. They really don't want people to tell them what to do. So I think for your listeners is to find out, either by contacting us or just looking around to see if they have an event like this in their local community. And I think reaching out to the roundups themselves to talk, you know, to express, you know, if you're local, if it's in your state, to say like, hey, you know, I would really love to support this event, but I don't support the mass slaughter of native wildlife. And, you know, I'd love to come out if you were doing it this way instead. And, you know, we can help connect people with local groups and organizations that would be willing to help some of these roundups change. So one in Georgia that we often use as a model for change, just a few years ago was a slaughter festival rattlesnake roundup, and is now a rattlesnake and wildlife festival. And a couple local nonprofits worked with the roundup organizers directly to make that move, so that when they decided to no longer kill snakes, they were ready to go. They had local people who were going to bring in captive animals to do shows, and, you know, the same environmental groups and wildlife groups that used to criticize this festival now have tables and give talks there. And so I think that makes all the difference, is trying to, you know, I say that I need to show the same compassion that I want people to show for snakes to the people that operate these roundups, if we want them to change, because that's what people respond best to. And, you know, I get it. I understand that the money is important. And, you know, if you've grown up in that culture, and also with the same like myths and stories that we've all grown up with, that snakes are evil and dangerous and we just can't live with them, you're not going to think there's anything wrong with those events. And that doesn't make you a monster. That just, you know, that's just how you've grown up. But that doesn't mean that people can't change if we're nice and understanding about it, and approach it that way. So, yeah, if people want to look around in their local area, and if they're having trouble figuring that out, they're welcome to get in touch with us, and I'm happy to talk to people about the different ways we can work together. We're trying to put together a documentary to get the word out more about rattlesnake roundups, because that's how people find out about a lot of issues, and it seems to be, at least at the moment, affecting change in some other areas. So, you know, of course, money always helps with that too, but I'm happier when people are wanting to, you know, to do something instead of just writing a check. But I mean, checks are great too.
So I want to tell a quick story, my one quick rattlesnake story, and then close by asking you about Advocates for Snake Preservation, like a 30-second version. And my quick rattlesnake story, I was probably 10 years old. I grew up in Colorado, and I saw a lizard. I was up hiking in the mountains, and I saw a lizard crawl under a bush. So immediately, of course, I'm 10 years old. I've got to crawl under the bush after it for whatever silly reason that 10-year-olds have. And I'm crawling, and all of a sudden I hear this this bee buzzing by my ear, and I brush it away, but it won't go away. The bee won't go away, so I keep brushing. And then finally I look to my right, and there's a rattlesnake about, an inch away from me. I mean, 2 inches from my head. And the point is that I know this is only a sample size of one, but I was there for, 5 or 10 seconds or 30, 20 seconds, I don't know how long, brushing it away before I actually saw it. And all it did was threaten me. It had absolutely no interest in actually, it was just telling me to get lost. It had absolutely no interest in actually harming me.
Yeah, they need that venom for their food because they can't, they have to kill what they eat, and that actually helps digestion as well. So they really don't want to bite us. And honestly, they don't want to rattle until they're pretty sure they've already been seen, because they're scared to death of us. And yeah, so it is sample size of one for you, but it's a story that, I hear or I've experienced more times than I like to admit, the times I've gotten too close to one. And thankfully, nothing has happened. And it hasn't happened because of them, not because of me.
So last question. How do people, literally 30 seconds, how do people, tell me about Advocates for Snake Preservation and how people can help?
Right. So Advocates for Snake Preservation is a nonprofit that my partner and I founded a few years ago, because of this problem that we saw with conservation being hard for an animal that people didn't like. We formed this organization to change people's hearts and minds towards snakes and make conservation easier. And then we've sort of branched into more activism type stuff, like rattlesnake roundups that needs to be acted on right now. So the easiest way to find us is our website, which is snakes.ngo, like non-governmental organization. And if you want to go directly to information about rattlesnake roundups and how you get involved with that, we have a website set up at rattlesnakeroundups.com.
Well, thank you so much for your work, and thank you for being on the program. And I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Melissa Amarello. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.